with Scott Allen.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you are in this beautiful world. I am your host, Scott J. Allen, and this is Phronesis, Practical Wisdom for Leaders. Now, I am a professor of management at John Carroll University in Cleveland, Ohio, USA. In addition, I'm a husband and father of three teens. Now, this is a family endeavor. Will played the intro, Kate voiced the intro, and who knows, you may hear from Emily a little later. I'm also an author, entrepreneur, speaker, and co-founder of the Collegiate Leadership Competition. I love to travel, explore new places with family, and learn from others. Phronesis offers a smart, fast-paced discussion about all things leadership and followership, if we're honest. My guests are scholars and practitioners, and we cover relevant topics and incorporate practical tips designed to help you make a difference in how you lead and live. I am proud to share a few updates. According to Listen Notes, Phronesis is listed as among the top 3% of podcasts in the world because of you. So thank you. In addition, the podcast has two sponsors. First, Phronesis is the official podcast of the International Leadership Association, an association that is near and dear to my heart. ILA brings together leaders and those who teach, study, and develop leadership, advancing leadership knowledge and practice for a better world. Learn more at ila-net.org. My second sponsor is the Bowler College of Business at John Carroll University. At Bowler, we offer several advanced degrees and MBAs, and I'm confident that there's one that will fit your location, interests, and timeline. In fact, our online MBA is ranked as the number one in Ohio and number nine in the United States. We offer international study tours, a contemporary and forward-looking curriculum, and access to senior leaders and flagship organizations. Learn more at business.jcu.edu. You can find links to both sponsors in the show notes. Now, if you like what we're up to, please hit subscribe so you can stay current as we release new episodes each week. You can also share what we're up to with others, friends, colleagues, leaders, teams, students, and others you think will benefit. And now, today's show. Okay, everybody, welcome to the Phronesis podcast, wherever you are in the world. Today, I have a very, very special guest. The Right Honorable Beverly McLaughlin served as Chief Justice of Canada from 2000 to mid-December 2017. In June 2018, she was made a Companion of the Order of Canada, the country's highest accolade. She works in ADR as a bilingual arbitrator and mediator in Canada and internationally. During her 28 years on the Supreme Court of Canada, she helped decide a wide variety of common law and civil law disputes in both French and English. Her tenure as Chief Justice was the longest in Canadian history. The 2,094 Supreme Court of Canada judgments in which she participated, of which she wrote 442, and her legal writings and speaking include a wide range of subjects in corporate, construction, financial services, taxation, contract, tort, IT, patent, copyright, other areas of business law, as well as arbitration and mediation. She has received over 35 honorary degrees from universities in Canada and abroad, and numerous other honors and awards. She's a Distinguished Leadership Award winner in the ILA. And Ms. McLaughlin also sits as Justice of Singapore's International Commercial Court and the Hong Kong Final Court of Appeal. She is an author, she is a lover of dogs, and she is with us today. Thank you so much for being with us, Beverly. We very, very much appreciate your time.
It's a great pleasure to be with you, Scott.
What else do listeners need to know about you before we jump into the conversation? Maybe something that wasn't in your bio.
I think you've covered it pretty well. I also love nature and I love cooking and food. But apart from that, I read voraciously and I'm just curious about life and curious about the world. And I managed to maintain that into my 80th year. So that's good news for me anyway, because it's kept life very interesting.
Well, curiosity is a superpower. It really is. Oh my. Well, that's wonderful. I too love the outdoors and I cannot wait to get to Lake Louise. We have not made it to that part of the world just yet, but it looks absolutely incredible. Of course, you're in a beautiful part of the world as well, out there on the West Coast.
I grew up in southwestern Alberta, not far from just south of where Lake Louise and Banff and those, in the foothills. It's one of the most beautiful parts of the world. I may just think that because that's where I grew up, but I sincerely, I've been all over and I really do believe you must get there, Scott.
It is on our list. It is on our list. Well, I wanted to jump into the conversation today. And as I mentioned before we started, just really explore a couple different areas. As I was doing some research on you, I came across this notion of conscious objectivity. I know that you're speaking of it in the concept of the law, but I thought to myself, you know, there's some really nice parallels to leadership potentially as a person who's in a position of authority. So maybe help listeners understand that terminology and how you think about it. And then maybe we can explore how it aligns with the role of serving as a leader.
Yeah. Well, one of the things that came to me as I started judging and got a little bit more experience and started trying to figure out what the job was, that one of the big impediments to getting to the right solution, if you wish, is seeing things through your own lens or one particular lens and not appreciating other points of view. So in the context of judging, we'll simplify it, we'll say we have two parties before a judge, and each one has her own story. And they are different stories, or each of them has a view about how to apply the law or what the law says. And they are different ideas about how to apply the law or what the law requires. So they strive mightily to present their own individual view of the facts and the law and how the case should be worked out. And one approach a judge can take is to say, well, I prefer this party's approach to the facts, law, etc., to the other parties. And if the judge does that early in the proceeding, it creates something that in police work they call tunnel vision, which is you are seeing everything through the lens of a particular narrative. And after you unconsciously, perhaps, start seeing everything through the lens of that particular narrative, it becomes very hard to see it or appreciate the other narratives, because there are self-confirming biases that go on in our perceptual. I'm not a psychiatrist or a psychologist that hesitate to say, but once you've bought into a story and you think it's pretty good, your brain tells you it's good, and you have your own side in that issue, if you wish, because mentally you're kind of aligned with that. So when other facts or other perspectives come along, you resist them unconsciously, usually. And this is why, for example, in the world of the internet, people tend to be gravitating to the same kind of message and the same posts and so on all the time. It confirms their biases, unconscious biases. So as a judge, getting back to judging, I thought my job is to be fair to both parties. And I have to really guard against either imposing my own personal view or buying into one view and thereby unconsciously perhaps setting up resistance to the other view. So I developed this idea of conscious objectivity, and I would actually consciously try to put myself into the shoes of each of the parties and imagine through an exercise, conscious exercise, what it would be like to have suffered what they suffer or encountered what they encountered, and how I would feel if I had encountered or suffered that. And I used to think it was a little like being, not that I am an actor, but being an actor and saying, you've got to play a bad guy. Well, how do I play the bad guy or the good guy or any woman? How do I do that? I do that by imagining what it would be like to be that person. And only after I can do that with my imagination can I be convincing in that role. So by this act of imagination, I would try to put myself in the position of each of the parties. And I would sort of keep up that questioning attitude throughout the whole process of fact-finding and law-finding and so on. And I believe that it really helped me to be a fairer judge, to see both sides of a question. So how does that apply to leadership? Well, I hadn't thought about this before, but now that you raise it, I think that it really raises some interesting ideas and questions. Often leaders are in the position where they are because of what they believe and what they have loudly and clearly said they believe. And this is what I stand for. And that is perceived as being the strong leader.
Yes.
But we can see what that can do, right? It can blind that leader to other perspectives. And so the person is leading and maybe leading like-minded people who think that she is doing just a great job. But when she gets into the actual business of dealing with conflicts, dealing with problems, dealing with different points of view, that leader can be paralyzed because her vision may have little to do with or little traction with the new reality that is being presented to the leaders. So they're saying, yes, I vowed that I would never raise interest rates, take it banal. But now they've got a situation where everybody's telling them you have to raise interest rates. And what do they do? Now, that's a silly example. But I do believe, now that you've made me think about it, this ability to put yourself in other people's shoes and imagine what it would be like to be in their shoes is an essential quality of leadership and one that's often overlooked. And it may not help people get elected, but it certainly impedes this lack of conscious objectivity, would impede the performance in the office and ultimately lead to the defeat of the leader or the inability of the leader to achieve his or her objectives.
Well, yes. I mean, what's so interesting, you talked about confirmation bias, and I think there's a visual, it's an image on the internet. I don't know the validity or the source. I'll put it in the show notes. But it's interesting because it displays 180 known cognitive biases that we suffer from, whether that's inattentional blindness. Another one is that we tend to see the faults in others more easily and readily than we see the faults in ourselves. So there's conceptual blocks, rules we have that are in our head that aren't there. So it's so fascinating because, yes, I think we're kind of almost... we walk around the earth thinking that we have a clear picture of what's happening in front of us. And then there's the Dunning-Kruger effect, which is, you know, people tend to overestimate their abilities, which if you suffer from that, that's too bad. That we're going to struggle. So I love the conscious portion of that, because I think we do have to remain conscious of how we can be almost, this is the wrong word potentially, but seduced into, again, to your point, if I like this narrative from the beginning, now I'm, from confirmation bias perspective, I'm just hearing all the things that kind of confirm that bias. And if I don't have a way to kind of get out of that, to bring myself out of that mindset, I can struggle. And, you know, another thing that I thought of was Harper Lee's To Kill a Mockingbird. And this is going to go back to law, but Atticus explains to Scout, you never really understand a person until you consider things from his point of view, until you climb into his skin and walk around in it. And I just love the phrasing of you working to place yourself in the position of these other individuals and how they might see the world.
Yeah, I agree with you. And I think that's our big challenge in all areas of life, to see the other person's point of view, whether it's personal relations or work relations or whatever, but certainly in leadership. I mean, what's leadership about? It's about trying to do what is right for large numbers of people, and they're going to have divergent views and perspectives. And so you have to understand what it's like to be in their skin, to quote Atticus, to really know how to be wise and how to solve the problems that you face.
I hadn't thought about this before asking the question, but from a leadership standpoint, if, to your point, I have a path that I think we should go down and I'm surrounded by yes people or people who are afraid to dissent, do I consciously say to the team, what's the downside of us moving in this direction? What are the limitations of this path forward? Because we've all sat in meetings where an authority figure made a decision, no one really spoke up, but also no one was really all that bought in. Yeah. And then we walk out of the room and we have trouble. And people in positions of authority have to chip away. You know, not everyone's going to always get their way or have their idea be chosen, but we do need to create an environment where we can look at some of these things objectively from all angles so that we can make the best decision in these really, really complex situations.
Yeah, I agree with that. And the yes man or yes boss or yes woman attitude, I think, can be a very dangerous thing. I worked for many, many years, the biggest part of my career, as an appellate judge. And there are built-in organizational features of doing that job that really help guard against what you have been describing. Because, for example, in Supreme Court of Canada, there are 9 judges and no one's the boss. You may be the chief justice, but you don't get your way. You're not the boss. Your vote doesn't count any more than anybody else's. And everyone is encouraged to speak freely and stand up and say what they think. And they have a right to dissent, which reinforces that they don't have to come to a collective single decision. So all of those institutional features help guard against the problem of the strong leader who doesn't get the other side of the story. And I do agree with you that I think it's one problem one sees often in the political sphere, although you can have institutional features there that help bring, we can all think of them, opposing voices to bear. But sometimes at the executive level, particularly where you have Canada situation, I'm not talking about a particular situation, but let's take Great Britain, a prime minister or something like that, a people person who has maybe a president of the United States, I don't know, but I'm just using that not to single out a particular person, but you get someone at the executive level who can have very strong views, and they will have ways of insulating themselves from opposing views. And that may get in the way of a full and free debate. And another thing is, it's often thought that political leaders should have checklists and that they should be able to give their ministers or the people that they delegate to look after a particular problem a checklist, and that presidential or prime ministerial appointment, that person has to do what the central person wants. And that can become a problem too, because the person who's been delegated the responsibility for looking after finance or foreign affairs or suddenly sees a lot of complexities that maybe don't fit with the checklist. So we have all these tendencies built into our executive branches of institutions, be they corporations or governments or just the institutions of educational, other kinds of institutions, that unless they're consciously checked may lead to this tunnel vision syndrome, this idea that we've got the right narrative and we have to play that out and we don't want to hear anything to the contrary, which means we just see half the picture or maybe less.
Yes. And speaking of the full picture, you know, another line of questioning I would love to kind of go down and explore with you is the role you were in. You were placed often in a situation where you had to, quote unquote, let large factions of people who felt a certain way about something, let them down, make decisions that they wouldn't agree with. And that's a very challenging place to be in. And so just on a personal level, how did you navigate that pressure and that stress? And then, you know, for people who are listening to the podcast and people who themselves are in positions of authority and they at times have to let people down, are there any tips that you have that, you know, as you do that work, here's some things to consider or think about? Because leadership oftentimes, at least if you read the airport books, it's all chocolate bars and warm fuzzies. And that's not true.
Well, I think of it in 2 stages, both of which are important. This business of coping with letting people down. The first is the pre-decision stage, where you're having to make the difficult decision. And at this point, you can be influenced by the fear that you'll be letting certain people down, or the desire to play to a certain sector who supports you. That can get in the way of your making the right decision. So as a judge, I always set my mind as best I could to make the right decision in the case on the facts and on the law. It's not always clear, but I would work very, very hard to come to a conclusion on a balance of probabilities, or if it's a criminal case, beyond a reasonable doubt, what happened, look at it methodically, analytically, apply the law analytically. And then I would know that I'm making the right decision. And I would try to banish or not consider or allow myself to be influenced by the fact that I knew that this particular decision that I had arrived at after a lot of work, doing my best, would not sit well with certain people. Sometimes with people who are very close to you and share the same values or look to you as someone who's going to help them, and you have to disappoint them. So the first stage is, I think, just being prepared that you have to make the decision on the right basis, using the tools at your hand in your profession or in your genre, and make that decision with integrity and not allow yourself to be influenced by personal considerations of fear or favor. And that's why judges have independence, because they're very fortunate in that. No, you can't kick a judge out, except in the United States. Of course, you can vote them out in certain states, but in our system in Canada and in throughout much of the common law world, judges have absolute independence. And that is so they will make those tough decisions without fear or favor. So that's the first stage. And the second stage is you've got to be prepared for the hit. And you know that you will be severely criticized. I remember once I had to write a difficult decision, which women's groups hated. And I could see their point of view, but I thought that it was the right decision. I thought in the long run, it was the way the law should go. And I remember a friend saying, why did you have to write that? Let one of the men write that. And I said, well, because it's my job and I don't shrink from doing what I need to do, regardless of gender. But in the aftermath, you suffer. And of course, you hate, we all hate to let those we love or those we admire or those whose goals we share think badly of us or think we've done the wrong thing. But we simply have to say we do as judges. That's part of the job. And it will come right in time. Or if I've made a mistake, there will be other courts and decisions to correct it, which was always a great solace to me. In the case I mentioned, that case where I was so vilified by so many women's groups, we had offered a blueprint to fix the law to Parliament, which they did. And the whole problem was solved in a way that did not involve the constitutional violation that we found was there. And it was my duty to uphold the Constitution, even if it had this adverse effect. And, you know, in the end, it worked out very, very well, because we have to remember that no decision ever stands by itself. They're always in context and they're always in flux and flow. So I make this decision and somebody's really angry with me about it, but there'll be a whole lot of other things happening and other people taking up other positions, and it's all going to move on. And in the end, if you've made the right decision, it'll probably become part of a process that will lead to a better situation. And I saw that happen many times in the courtroom situation. You make a decision that was roundly criticized, but with the passage of time, it turned out to have been the right decision. So always keep that long perspective and don't let yourself be too influenced or depressed or sad that people aren't liking what you're doing. Of course, if you're in the political realm or even certain business and social and so on, you can anger people so badly that you lose your leadership position. And that's a dynamic I never had to face as a judge. And I really think that it's salutary, whatever institution we are in, to take the long view and develop mechanisms that perhaps prevent us throwing out thoughtful people simply because we don't agree with what they've decided in a particular situation.
Hmm. And maybe that's also why you have a dog.
Yeah. I have to see things through the canine perspective.
No, just unconditional love when you get home.
Unconditional love when you get home. That's right. Yeah. Those are the things that really matter. And a supportive family, if you have the good fortune, which I have had, to have supportive partners and so on, and family. I mean, they may say, gosh, did you have to do that? Did you have to take that one on? But they're there for you. And you know that when you get home at night, when you face yourself in the mirror in the morning, that really, really helps.
Well, as you think about this topic of leadership, just one more question. What are you thinking about in recent times when it comes to this topic? What's kind of ruminating for you as you think about the topic of leadership?
Well, I've been thinking lately about how one can be effective and what makes you effective as a leader. And of course, there are a million answers to that and hundreds of books. But I think it's not something innate you grab out of the sky. It's quite a methodical process. First of all, I think you need to develop the tools, whatever field you're in. get that degree. I mean, I talk to young people, I just did last week, you know, who've been going to school for 6 or 7 years, and they say, I just want to stop. I just want to get out there and do stuff. And I had to tell this young woman last week, I said, don't stop now. You're just on the threshold of being called to the bar, of getting this incredibly important tool that will help you do whatever you want. So hang in there. Get your degree, get your tools, get your experience so that you are equipped. And I think just as we wouldn't take a trek up a mountain without the proper equipment, we shouldn't embark on a leadership challenge without equipping ourselves. That may be getting help, that we can operate as a community, we can operate as a group. I don't have to have all the tools if I can enter a community where we can bring all of our tools together. But think about tools. Think about how you put yourself in a leadership position. And then the next thing I like to think about is opportunity and vision. I think they're two sides of the same coin. So many people can't, they say, what can I do? The young people come to me and say, what can I do to make a difference? And I can never answer that question, but it's a personal question they have to answer. And the answer has to come from their values, their beliefs, and from looking around and seeing where the needs are. And so that question, what can I do? What should I do? Is very, very important. And don't expect somebody else to tell you exactly what it is. You have to figure it out for yourself. And then the final thing I've been thinking about recently is the importance of collective action and working with others. I think no leader can do it on their own. That's why they are a leader, I suppose. But so many leaders, so many people have ideas of leadership that if you get the right person in place, that person will be the one who delivers all the answers, who will take your organization where it should go, da, da, da. And that there's some truth in that. But the fact is that I've observed through life that effective leaders are community builders. They work with others. They have to have others with them, supporting them, advising them, criticizing them, which we talked about earlier, in order to be effective. And they are then able to, often with highly developed communication skills, other skills, convey that collective vision. But I always say to people, really develop your groups, your relationships. They are absolutely essential to you being effective as a leader.
Well, you know, the first part of your answer even reminded me of our conversation a little bit, like equipping yourself with some tools. And there's a gentleman named Ray Dalio. I don't know if you know that name. He founded a company in the United States called Bridgewater. And he wrote a book called Principles for Dealing with a Changing World Order. It's a fascinating read if you get an opportunity. So he loves principles, and he has these principles that kind of guide how he does the work. And so if we go back to even the beginning of our conversation, conscious objectivity, that's a principle, and that's helping. It's a tool, we could also call it, but it's helping guide the work. And I think you named a couple other things in there that as you think about the work, you have these guideposts that help you do that work. And I think having those, just even making conscious objectivity explicit, helps you do better work. So mm-hmm. For me, at least what I heard in there is, of course, it's, you know, there was a gentleman on the podcast and he said, his name is Ron Riggio. He said, leaders don't do leadership. It's co-created by leaders and followers working together. So yes, it's collective. And number two, you're right. I can't tell you how you make a difference. You need to, you know, figure that out. And what are you passionate about? What do you have in your heart that you want to make a difference in the world? And then have you equipped yourself to do the work? And I love it. I think it's wonderful. Well, as we begin to wind down our time together today, what has caught your attention in recent times? What have you been reading or streaming or listening to? It could have to do with the law or leadership. It might have nothing to do with the law or leadership. But does anything stand out for you?
Well, it's hard for me to articulate this, but I feel sometimes overwhelmed at the increasing complexity of every issue, every problem we face. I know issues have always been complex, but we live in a time when change is happening very rapidly. And when there are so many important issues or vectors interacting to create what some people have called wicked problems, the kind of problem where if you pull on one string, the whole entity shifts and you've got another kind of problem. But you think about the concurrence of problems we're facing, very, very serious challenges with climate change and the survival of our planet as we know it, migration en masse that's going along with that throughout the world, the challenges of diversity, which are the result of that and create conflicts, too many people with too many different faiths and perspectives living on the same patch of land. All of these things, and I could go on and talk about nuclear weapons, but you get my picture. Yeah. We're living in a time when there are so many threats, so many existential problems, and everybody's trying to deal with them all at once because we have no choice but to deal with them all at once. And when you pull on one string, you're doing something with the other. And it's making leadership, it's making living extremely difficult in these times. And that's what I think about. Not sure I have any answers as to how we can simplify this or come up with a code for dealing with all these complex and interlocking challenges at the same time. But it is what I'm preoccupied with. And then also an offshoot of that is people faced with fear and complexity are more and more driven to what they call the strong leader, populist style government, where you do away with the complexity by imposing a vision that seems clear and straightforward, which is extremely, in my respectful opinion, dangerous because it's a form of willful blindness and lead you down the wrong paths completely. Anyway, that's what preoccupies me.
I understand. A lot of shifts occurring that I couldn't agree with you more, whether it's digitization, climate change.
I left that one out. And the whole social media thing and how our lives have changed and our ways of communicating. I mean, I'd forgotten that one when I talked about my vectors, but it's huge.
Well, I think for each one of us, trying to make sense of some of that complexity is an important endeavor, just to even begin to wrap our heads around some of what's occurring, because it's important. It's very, very, very important. Well, Judge, thank you. I appreciate you being with me today. This has been a wonderful conversation. Thank you for the service that you have obviously given to your country and to the world. Thank you for being just an incredible role model and a leader in so many different ways. And so this conversation has been just absolutely wonderful. And I wish you all the best. Thank you so much.
Well, I've enjoyed it a great deal, Scott. And thank you for bringing me into your world.
Thank you so much. Be well.
You too. Bye.
What an honor it was to speak with Beverly. Just an incredible opportunity. And the practical wisdom for me in that conversation is that she had just done a wonderful job of creating some, for lack of a better term, hacks for helping her disrupt some of the cognitive biases that each one of us are susceptible to. I think there's an infographic on the internet. There's 180 plus cognitive biases that each one of us suffer from. And how do we, when making decisions, avoid some of those traps? How do we limit their impact on our decision making? And then I just really, really loved that conversation around, at times as a leader, we need to disappoint factions of people. And having a mindset and preparing self for having to be placed in that situation, I think it is an important, important consideration. So, a couple things. One, thanks for listening. Two, I have a newsletter, and that newsletter is designed to get good content in the hands of hungry people who are interested in leadership, move past some of the simplistic memes that we might see on LinkedIn, and get some better content to folks. So if you have a class, or if you are in a leadership role, or you are just curious, that link can be found in the show notes. International Leadership Association Conference 2024, November 7 through 10. So please place that on your agenda. As always, thanks so much for listening in. Take care, be well, and if you like what we're doing, share it with others. Bye-bye. You have just finished another episode of Practical Wisdom for Leaders with Scott Allen. To contact me, visit www.scottjallen.net or send me a note at scott@scottjallen.net. I can also be found on Twitter and LinkedIn, so let's connect. Now, if you have feedback, I'd love to hear it. And as always, thank you so much for listening. One final nod to our sponsors, the International Leadership Association and the Bowler College of Business at John Carroll University. And now, here's Kate's twin sister, Emily, with the outro.
You've been listening to Phronesis, Practical Wisdom with Scott Allen.